Thank you so much, Bobby. Thank you, Justin. And thank you very much, Chrissy. Where did Chrissy go? There she is. Hi, Chrissy. I lost you for a second for that reading from Maureen Killoran. Maureen's in-laws live right behind me in Salem. And so I often see her mother-in-law hiking down my driveway with her big stick. She's 87 years old and still puts her own old-fashioned tire chains on. So very impressive, impressive family. Well, many of our fundamentalist brothers and sisters believe that the Bible's book of Genesis contains all the science we'll ever need to know. The books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, plus a dash or two of the New Testament, provide the law, good enough for everyone at any time, in any place. So, is the book of Numbers where we should get our mathematics? Actually, Numbers is a book that's filled with laws, along with some ripping good adventure stories. The original Hebrew name for this book is Bemidbar, or in the desert, which might not make you think of math at all. It makes you think of want. But what is it that the people want? They want food. Well, actually, they've got food. Moses has led them to a place where they can get all they can eat of that famous food known as manna from heaven, because it seems to appear from out of nowhere while they're sleeping. The people went round gathering it and ground it in a mill or crushed it with a pestle. It was then cooked in a pot and made into pancakes. It tasted like cake made with oil. When the dew fell on the camp at nighttime, the manna fell with it. It's really an insect secretion that forms on tamarisk trees, used even today as food by desert nomads. But no Bible stories had taught them that. There were no Bibles yet, of course. They'd been living as slaves, building the cities and monuments of Egypt, so they didn't know very much about open places like the desert. But they did know good cuisine, and they soon got bored with their divine pancakes. So the Israelites began to weep again. "Who will give us meat to eat?" they said. "Think of the fish we used to eat in Egypt. The cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. But now we're withering away. There's nothing wherever we look except this manna." You would think that having plenty of food to survive on would be enough for anyone who has just escaped from generations of slavery. The waters of the sea have parted, they've crossed to safety, while all their pursuers have been drowned. God has liberated them. They're free at last to go their own way. But now, what do they want? Meat and fish in the middle of the desert, plus cucumbers, leeks, onions, and garlic. Here in the desert of Numbers, where they should be counting their blessings, they seem ready to give it all up for what? Bad breath and belching? What are God and Moses to do with such people? What should we do now? Why don't we sing? Just no loud burping, please, for those who had cucumbers for breakfast. Thank you very much. That's such a beautiful song, such a beautiful melody form. Those notes are also shared by one of the most beautiful ragas in India. There's a raga called Karaharapriya. Doesn't that sound sweet? And that was a very, very important moment in my life when I first heard a song sung in that mode. Changed my life. I told Justin about this earlier, and I said, but no pressure. Please understand, no pressure. So we're in the desert with those people. Complaints, complaints, complaints. Everybody's got them. And it's not just the people. God and Moses add a good number of their own complaints to this cranky book of Numbers. Moses heard the people weeping, each family at the door of its tent. Yahweh, that's the personal name of God, Yahweh's anger was greatly aroused. Moses, too, found it disgraceful, and he said to God, "Why do you treat your servants so badly? In what respect have I failed to win your favor for you to lay the burden of all these people on me? Was it I who conceived all these people? Was I their father for you to say to me, carry them in your arms like a foster father carrying an unweaned child to the country? Where am I to find meat to give all these people, pestering me with their tears and saying, give us meat to eat? I cannot carry all these people on my own. The weight is too much for me. It's like that bird who laid an egg three times her size. If this is how you mean to treat me, please kill me outright. If only I could win your favor and be spared the sight of my misery. It's hard to say if Moses is just looking for a sympathetic ear or if he really expects God to provide. Complaining like an angry father seems to make things worse. God tells him to assemble the people at the tent of meeting, which must have been something like the principal's office. Bring them there and say to the people, purify yourselves for tomorrow, and you will have meat to eat, since you have wept in God's hearing, saying, who will give us meat to eat? How happy we were in Egypt. Very well, God will give you meat to eat. You will eat it not for one day, or two, or five, or 10, or 20, but for a whole month until it comes out of your nostrils and sickens you. Since you have rejected God who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? Now, bad enough when it's just dad. It's even worse when mom gets mad. You can imagine God shaking a rolling pin or a big wooden spoon. First I gave you freedom and I feed you all that manna from heaven, and now you want meat plus garlic, leeks, and onions. What, so you can find each other in the dark by sniffing? I'll give you meat, so much that you'll be sorry for ever asking. Here's how she does it. A wind sent by Yahweh started blowing from the sea, bringing quails, which it deposited on the camp. They lay for a distance of a day's march either side of the camp, 2 cubits thick on the ground. The people were up all that day and night and all the next day collecting quails. The least gathered by anyone was 10 homer. And then they spread them out round the camp. The meat was still between their teeth, not even chewed, when God's anger was aroused by the people. God struck them with a very great plague. So now the people lie in heaps as well. That's what you get for asking. They had asked for meat, and they'd asked for fish, but what they got was quails. I guess that birds come somewhere in between the other two, the mammal and the fish, in the great order of things. They lay 2 cubits, or about 3 feet thick, 10 homers minimum per person in volume, or 3,600 liters, numbers enough to sicken everyone in the whole book of Numbers. They stopped chewing, but even if they stopped eating, imagine what would happen once all those fowl went foul, spread for miles around. What more could God do to rub their noses in it? It was once common, some of you may remember, to punish kids for smoking by making them sit down and finish off a whole pack. It's a time-honored method. Give them what they think they want, just more than they can stand. The worst Christmas I ever had was one when I got exactly what I asked for. Let me explain. I was 8 years old. My parents had separated. My sister and I were living with my mom in Florida while Dad stayed back in Illinois. He came down one late September to visit, and the adults tried unsuccessfully to work out some sort of reconciliation. The tension was deeper than cubits of quails, and things started going bad quickly. My sister and I were just little kids, and of course we were worried about how Christmas was going to go, especially in the presents department. To call us selfish would hardly be justice, but that's what our parents saw. They decided to take us shopping separately. Mom took my sister someplace else for girl things, while Dad took me to where they had toys and sporting goods. The idea was pretty much buy them everything they asked for so they can't complain. They couldn't hear each other, had run out of things to say, and now they didn't want to hear any more from their children either. All I can remember my dad saying as we shopped was, now what else do you want? I guess I really was a selfish kid because I can't remember anything that my sister got while shopping with our mom. No, I just can't remember. But honestly, I only remember one of my own so-called presents. For months I've been watching commercials for the great Garlou, the green creature that you see on the cover of your order of service. He was inspired by the monsters of cheap sci-fi movies. Garlou the Mighty, Garlou the Untamed, Garlou the Terrible. The ads showed him towering over a cityscape made of toy trains and buildings, knocking things down and causing panic in the streets. Next, the camera pans back and we see a boy and his sister playing together. The announcer says in tones of great concern, "Who can stop him? Who can control this monstrous creature?" And then he shifts to a happy voice. We all know that voice. "You can, kids! With these battery-operated controls, you can make Garlou go, stop, bend, pick up, turn." The boy uses the controls to make Garlou grasp his sister's doll with green foam rubber-padded hands. He brings the doll to where she's having a nice tea party with all of her other dolls. She nuzzles him gratefully like he was a clever puppy. "Yes, great Garlou, almost 2 feet tall, will be your faithful servant." Garlou brings the boy a teacup from his sister's table, and the whole scene of catastrophic destruction has become one of cheerful domestic sharing. Garlou's just part of a big, happy family. Now, why would a kid in my situation have wanted a toy like that? But there was no joy for me in the great Garlou. Not when I picked him out, my father brought him to the counter. Not when I went through the charade of opening him on Christmas morning after he'd been wrapped. Our parents' tactics were every bit as powerful as those of God and Moses had been for the fussing Hebrews. Rub their noses in it. That should stop their endless demands and petitioning for this, that, and the other. It's a tactic that can be very effective for discouraging individuals or communities. At least, it seems like it should be. Sometimes I wish that I could use it myself. Sometimes I get frustrated with people in this country, like when I hear that bacon-wrapped corn dogs are selling out at state fairs all over the country, in a country that's struggling with its weight. Don't stop with the corn dogs. Push the idea of a fourth meal. Layer on the extra slabs of meat and cheese and wash it down with soft drinks by the gallon. As I was writing this sermon, starting on it, two young guys came into the library where I was working with soda mugs so big that you could farm fish in them. Or raise flocks of quails. Let's just deep fry everything, including melons and cucumbers, before they even reach the store. I get at least as cranky as Moses when people seem to vote against their own best interests, or worse, when they fail to vote at all. Sometimes I want to say, fine, go ahead. Vote a straight ticket of anti-government vandals and let's see how they govern. Let's see how you like private roads and bridges with armed toll collectors every 10 miles or so. I'm winding up now. Enjoy your red state lifestyle with those staggeringly higher rates of teen pregnancy, divorce, suicide, and violent crime. And yes, dependence on government programs. Funny how where families are the least intact, you hear family values preached the loudest. If you blame secular law and government for not keeping things together, replace it with religious law, as long as it's the right religion. Why stop there and not go further? Go ahead, get your science from the Bible and teach that to your kids. Outlaw abortion and contraception. Restrict the sale of any medicines that have been developed through applied evolutionary theory. Give the crazies power, and then see if you can make the monster you've unleashed bend and serve you like the great Garlou. Let them carry us all to a nice little tea party where we'll enjoy perfect domestic tranquility now and forevermore, except for the occasional religious war that's been called for, both at home and overseas. Do it all for God and country, and may God rub your noses in it. You better take a deep breath through my nose and let it out slowly. You can do it again. You've all heard about doing this in church. Okay, that's better. Maybe God and Moses should have done the same before they threw a tantrum while leading folks to their new country. After all, what did the people really mean when they asked for meat, fish, melons, cucumbers, onions, leeks, and garlic, like we used to eat in Egypt? Which really? Now, are they really rejecting freedom or being disloyal to their faith and their traditions? Let's think about those words, like we used to eat in Egypt, which really speak a mouthful of many different flavors. Manna from heaven might keep you alive, but it's not enough to help you thrive. And that's what the people want. A diet of nothing but pancakes won't do it any longer. They've been altered by their time among those other people, the Egyptians. Their tastes have changed and grown. They're a new people, bigger and more complex in experience and in desire. They're not just Hebrews anymore. They've Egyptianized a bit, though they might not even know it. God and Moses see the danger. If they've got a taste for Egypt now, what will they want in the future? We're headed for a land of milk and honey, but the next thing you know, they'll be adding cardamom or mint or other foreign flavors. Better nip this in the bud and then spit before we start to like the flavor too. Next thing you know, they're going to want scrambled egg super. But instead of spitting or cursing, what if God and Moses had offered their blessings? That's not the usual way things go with the human phenomenon that we call religion. I know. The book of Numbers, like so many religious texts, seems to advocate the idea of loyalty to one's own group and the exclusion of all others, of their gods, their customs, the food they eat, or the way that they eat it. But also, like so many religious texts, it pushes this to such extremes that it invites us to imagine alternatives. Heaps of dead birds and heaps of dead people just because we asked for more variety? Is this how we really want to live? Do we want to live on a religious, ethnic, and political monoculture? On a spiritual diet that's as flat as pancakes. Even if they're holy pancakes, do you think they'll be enough? Unity and solidarity can be wonderful, and I'm sure that's what the Bible seeks to cultivate. But it often seems to also cultivate exclusivity, a fear and hatred of the dangerous other that can easily fuel wars or an institutionalized cruelty that deforms our lives, even in peacetime. Can we have one without the other? Unity without exclusivity? I think that's a large part of what our own religious movement tries to do. Which brings me to your Christmas present. If you look on the back of your order of service, you'll see something new. Something went a little wrong with the heading on this side. It's only supposed to say the principles on one side. The principles and the living tradition. When I began serving here as your minister on the first Sunday of December, 7 years ago, I asked for our statement of principles and sources to be included there each time. And you said yes, you wanted that. Many, many thanks. You've made it so much easier for me to segue to the conclusion of so many sermons by saying, if you look at the back of your order of service, you'll see something important that will help you understand what I'm trying to say. Of course, I'm also saying it to prod you to reread and reclaim for another week what we might call our own one-page Bible, a quick reminder of what is special about this particular religious tradition. But I forgot back then to include the most important part, and it's been left out ever since. So here it is, finally, just in time for Christmas. It's something that you'll find in every religious tradition. It's a blessing, although it's a strange one. Grateful for the religious pluralism which enriches and ennobles our faith, we are inspired to deepen our understanding and expand our vision. As free congregations, we enter into this covenant, promising to one another our mutual trust and support. Does that seem a little long and awkward? Microsoft Word gave it the dreaded green line of bad grammar when I typed that in. Well, yes, the batter for this pancake is still a little bit lumpy. The celebration of pluralism and diversity is still something fairly new in that human phenomenon called religion. At the religious stage of the book of Numbers, God and Moses still aren't ready to count other people in. Stick to your pancakes. Stick to your own kind. It's that West Side Story. Stick to your own kind. Stick to your own. They aren't ready to see that blessing diversity supports the unity of the whole human family. But many of us do feel ready, and more feel ready every day. I don't mean to rub anyone's nose in it, but if this last election shows us anything, I think it shows us that. I know that right here, right now, we're eager to get on with the celebration. So let me wish happy holidays to all of you from me and the great Garland.